Welcome to 360 Degrees of Healthcare with Dr. Stan, an in-depth look at our industry from our very own Chief Medical Officer, who will talk with other medical and industry professionals on the changing and evolving landscape of the healthcare system from the inside.
My name is Dr. Stan Schwartz. I'm an infectious diseases physician on a lifelong journey from medical student to practicing physician to health system executive and now healthcare entrepreneur, and as a regular patient because getting older teaches you a lot about healthcare. Where are we going with genetics and genomic-based healthcare? I sat down with a geneticist friend and subject matter expert, Dr. Michael Kaiser. I've known Mike for almost two decades, back when we worked together at the same health system, and I've remained in touch with him as my go-to expert on anything related to DNA. As I work with employers analyzing their healthcare claims, I am continually struck by the increasing variety of genomic testing as well as some of the incredible costs. For example, a single test can cost as much as a knee arthroscopy and way more than a colonoscopy. And now there's direct marketing to consumers. That used to revolve around ancestry interests, but now it's more about risk and especially about predicting your future. It's all about being sure you are on medications that are aligned with your genetic makeup and, in the case of cancer, likely to target the unique gene profile of your tumor. Dr. Kaiser and I discuss all these topics, especially from the viewpoint of employers who purchase healthcare for their covered members. What's valuable and what's not? Should employers promote any of this testing? Dr. Mike Kaiser, thank you so much for being on our show today. We really appreciate your insight and your expertise you're going to bring into the field of genetics, or should I say genomics, or exactly what should I say, Mike?
Yeah, so that is a great start, and it's I appreciate you inviting me, Stan. Thanks for having me on your podcast. Genetics is the field where all this began. The easiest way to think of it is our genetics is our heredity. So it's what our parents give us to make us who we are. Genomics takes it to the next level, and it looks at all of the DNA, all of the information on a potentially cellular level. So with some of the breakthroughs with genetic testing and sequencing and driving costs down, we've now arrived at a genomic age, and that's exciting for people like me, but somewhat concerning for payers and doctors and to some level patients.
So I guess everybody who's listening to this podcast is familiar with 23andMe and the other home kits where you can get your own genetic analysis done. From the employer standpoint, from an employer that is sponsoring healthcare, are there any genomic tests that are really important for an employer to know about that look at risk factors for certain diseases? What, if any, are truly a value for the health of employers if their employees if they're covered, and what should an employer sponsor in a plan with good fiduciary responsibility, which is a watchword these days?
Yeah, it's there's a lot in your question. It's sometimes difficult to cover all of it. It's difficult for us to get the words right a lot of times. Genetics, genomics. What we've really always been after is what was also first called personalized medicine, and now we're referring to it as precision medicine. So the places where employers should really consider covering individuals for these kind of tests mostly is in the area of cancer today. We now have targeted therapies targeted towards a lot of these molecular markers and cancers, and we have drugs attached to them, and the FDA is looking at the drugs, and we're determining that efficacy is better, the outcomes are better. So for certain cancers, these genomic tests have now become first line, meaning as soon as you're diagnosed, we check. So lung cancer is a good example. I think they're up to about 8 or 9 markers now. that you just have to have because of the number of treatments available. So that's in the area of genomic medicine, precision medicine, but that's not genetic. Those are what are called acquired mutations. So as we go through life, the environment also impacts our DNA and changes it. So with cancer work, we need to test regularly. We need to test often because cancer changes. So with cancer, we're now to the point of how affordable can we make this testing since we know we're going to have to do it regularly. Cost of these tests is also drastically different from company to company. There's sometimes a tenfold swing in cost of some of these. One company can offer it for $200, $250, and another company offers it for $2,000 or $2,500, and it's the exact same information.
How would an employer help navigate people to the place that has a lower cost, or should they not be looking at cost, and how can they distinguish among the various providers in terms of quality?
I don't think that's been determined yet. I mean, we have certain companies that are outpacing other companies, but personally, I like variety and competition because that's where we'll figure out who's really best. 23andMe has done a great job. It started out as direct to consumer, more of a novelty. They had a lot of ancestry information. And then they added in things like, what kind of earwax do you have? Is it dry or is it wet? Do you like bitter tastes? How cilantro? And then they worked with the FDA to start adding more medical information. So I think the FDA allows them to report carrier status for 50 or 60 diseases now. I saw that their BRCA offering for breast cancer just increased by about 40 mutations. Just a few months ago, they were only offering the Ashkenazi Jewish mutations, and the FDA just gave them the okay to report back 40 additional ones. 23andMe, which is different than the targeted therapies and the tumor testing, is what's called polymorphism testing. So we have mutations in genes which knock out the function of the gene. That's a lot of what we deal with children with rare diseases. We do newborn screening for those sorts of things. We also have genetic changes that we all carry that greater than 1% of the population carries. And those are called polymorphisms. So those can make us tall, can make us short, can make us wide, can make us skinny. And that's really what 23andMe is focusing on, is those common polymorphisms that we're all at a potential to have.
So a polymorphism is not necessarily a genetic abnormality as much as it is a variation?
Correct. And it can have a significant reduction in function of a gene or of a protein or of an enzyme, but they're usually population-based or geographic-based. So in some community somewhere in the world, there became a survival advantage, and then the community all inherited it because it was advantageous. And so that's a lot of the time how polymorphisms are passed down and spread. We need a survival advantage to have it.
So going back to this question about risk, are there any current genomic tests that really would be beneficial for an employer to proactively put into a plan as far as helping covered members either get healthier or avoid diseases down the road? Anything established today as kind of a standard?
They're coming. I think today what I would say, where we are, look to the FDA's guidance. I think the FDA is up to about 30 or so gene therapies, about 160 or so targeted therapies. Their guidance is pretty good. As an employer, maybe start with those. In the pharmacogenomic world, which is medications and genetics, we know about 5% of people who take a medication have a risk for an adverse event. We should, as providers, know that when we start a medication, there's a chance that we create a new problem. Certain pharmacogenomic information will help us dose patients and choose medications better, so that those adverse events don't happen or lessened. Areas where it's acceptable to do today is cardiovascular medicine with Plavix and blood thinners. It's fairly accepted now that before you start a blood thinner, you should know your genetics. Personally, if I ever needed warfarin, my calculated dose, where I am today based on my size and my genetics, is 2.5 milligrams. That is well below the standard dose for warfarin. If I was given a standard dose, I would likely have a bleeding complication. It would be too much. We can check INRs, we can check PTs, PTTs, but if we start at the right spot, we're going to end at the right spot faster. The second area besides the cardiovascular would be the psychiatry field. Mental health is becoming a bigger deal. There's a lot more depression, a lot more anxiety. We have a lot of medications that may or may not work. We don't have a marker to follow. We have patient exams. We have patients telling us that it's helping or not helping. So that's another area where we're having the genomic information get you to the right place a lot faster, which should reduce costs. And that's probably where we are today with genomics, is a cost reducer for healthcare.
In the psychiatry field, is there testing now that would tell a doc that don't even bother giving this medication because it's either unlikely to work or likely to cause a severe adverse event?
Yes, that's how the reports are provided. So even 23andMe, which I mentioned was more of a novelty direct to consumer, they have the genomic information for drug metabolism. They provide a nice little report about it. Other companies provide a more complicated, more in-depth report. It gives you all the drugs. It gives you which enzymes they pass through. It tells you what your markers are. I don't know if that answered your question exactly, but it's part of the reason we have such a different cost to this stuff. 23andMe will give us over 1 million SNPs for around $100. And they give you all your own raw data. You could then use that information to learn either about yourself or to walk it through with a provider. We're not to the point where we're capable of doing that because so few people are educated on the information. So we're really hoping this AI machine learning, putting all the information in and just spitting out the answer, is going to help us move past that.
You foresee a day where AI will be really sitting at the doctor's side in terms of prescribing medications?
Yes. There's too many variables. There's really too many variables in our own biology, because a lot of these cytochrome P450 enzymes that we test for, it's not just our personal genetics that impacts them. It's also other medications and other things that those enzymes are actually supposed to be doing. They weren't put in our body to metabolize drugs. They were put in our body to recycle and metabolize things our body makes. So anytime we take a medication that goes through there, it changes. What we have is slow metabolizers, average metabolizers, and fast metabolizers. So it's like a red, green, yellow type report over tens of markers. So the test that I had developed, I think I did 64 markers. I believe CMS, which is Medicare, is saying there's about 6 or 7 markers that everyone should know.
Talk about this cytochrome P450, and that's the enzyme system that metabolizes things in your body, which fortuitously also metabolizes drugs that we take. Can that kind of an analysis tell a doc how often a drug should be taken if it tells you how quickly your body gets rid of it?
No, they can, but yes, that's exactly what they do, but in a little different way. So your body's getting rid of it by metabolizing it quicker. So it's changing it to something that our body can then excrete. If we go and we look at all the drug labels that have been approved by the FDA, and they're these 20-page documents, almost they all can contain information about the cytochrome P450. When a drug's developed, they have to do absorption studies, distribution studies, metabolism studies, and excretion studies. So then they report it back to us, and in the labels, they tell us what not to give with these medicines, what can upregulate one of these systems, what can downregulate the systems. So the information is there. We just don't quite know how to use it for people yet. It's really a second line. It's second line information after people fail first line in most instances.
So just for folks in our audience who may be listening, who are on treatment with some mental health type medications, and they aren't doing as well as they should, is this the kind of thing they should be asking docs about?
Definitely.
Let's turn to the other question that I had for you today, and that's gene therapy for genetic diseases, things that are inherited, heritable diseases. And, you know, we've gone now from genetic diseases being irreversible to now being potentially reversible. And I was reading about sickle cell anemia the other day, which now can be reversed at least for some period of time. What kind of things are available now? And for example, I was reading about a medication for one of the heritable spinal diseases that now has the world's most expensive drug for something like over $2 million per dose. What are we looking at now for things that we used to call untreatable that are now treatable?
Exciting times. I mean, it's exciting, but it's not going to be what people have been presented or what they think. When you think gene therapy, rightly so, you should assume that you have a genetic deficiency and that we can replace that and that you will be completely normal again. And we're not seeing that. We're not seeing that for most instances. We're struggling with things like, how do we get the DNA into the cell? How do we get the DNA into the right cell? How do we get it turned on only when it needs turned on? But again, we've moved 30 or so of these potential gene therapies through the FDA, and I think they have about 200 more applications. With the spinal muscular atrophy, you mentioned that drug was FDA approved. Now spinal muscular atrophy is recommended on every newborn screening panel in the country. The question with that one in particular is how much of the disease has already progressed by the time you get the gene therapy. So if there's already been cell death and symptoms, gene therapy is not going to reverse cells that don't grow back, which is typically neurons. We also see people becoming allergic or developing antibodies to the gene therapy or a part of the gene therapy, the part that allowed it to go into the cell. So we're learning a lot. We've improved on a lot. We're not all the way there. The cost of it I don't know how they came to the cost. The only thing I've heard is that they used information on the lifetime cost of a person with the disease. And that they said, if we made the disease go away, this is a reasonable price for the drug.
Going back to what you said there about the body developing antibodies against these, so you would actually, in a sense, start rejecting some of these DNA gene therapies?
Yes. And so right now, when we start to see evidence of it, and we saw it with some of the earlier enzyme therapies, we just increase the dose, try and overcome the resistance.
Can you talk a little bit about the example I gave a moment ago about sickle cell anemia and gene therapy for that disease, since it's so prevalent in some populations?
A gene therapy for sickle cell anemia and for the hemophilias and the other blood disorders would be fantastic. They're from the bone marrow. Those cells turn over all the time. It seems very amenable to gene therapy. I'm surprised we don't already have one. I don't have the details of what some of the holdups are. Sickle cell is the same mutation. Everybody who has sickle cell has the exact same mutation. So like for cystic fibrosis and some of their gene therapies, they only work for patients with particular mutations. So you can have cystic fibrosis. You don't have a gene therapy available, but a gene therapy that works for sickle cell would treat everybody with sickle cell.
Is that something that you think is on the horizon now?
My thought would be that it would be one of the first completed. I don't know why it's not or where the difficulties are. I haven't got that much into it to understand that at that level.
Are there any screening tests that you think should be? Well, you talked about the screening tests for newborns for spinal muscular atrophy. Are there any other screening tests that you think are going to become standard that are not standard now for young kids, young adults, early adulthood, and so forth?
Yes. Two things are happening almost at the same time. We can now do exome testing, which is sequencing all the genes that a person has that are associated with diseases. We do that regularly now on children with rare diseases. And we can do it fast if they're hospitalized. So 7 days, which is incredible. We're sequencing a genome, finding a cause for a rare disease in 7 days and sending it back to hospitals. In the process of doing that, we're actually reporting about 50 or 60 diseases on those children that affect them as adults. So the American College of Medical Genetics, which is my college, came out with a list of what's called secondary findings. So we determined that these were so important. We know they won't affect them until they're adults, but this will have such an impact on the family that they need to know. And so these are the cancer genes, BRCA1, BRCA2, Lynch syndrome. And then some of the cardiac genes, long QT, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It's been in the news with athletes and sudden death and cardiac stuff. Long QT and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, only about 20% of people who carry the risk have a symptom or an effect from it, but the first effect could be sudden death.
Wow.
So that's another example of a variant, maybe more than a mutation, that puts you at risk, but other things contribute to the effect or the cause. So we should, at some point in adulthood, be checked for cancer genes, cardiac stuff, things that we know have significant mortality. Then we're doing what's called cell-free DNA testing. We can draw blood on a mother and pull out the baby's DNA now. And so back in the day, we would do amniocentesis to determine if the baby had a chromosomal or a genetic problem. Now we draw mom's blood and we can reconstruct the baby's genetics and see if the baby has a problem. So a lot of pregnancies are getting covered by that. We're no longer doing advanced maternal age as the cutoff. We're doing more price point and affordability because the information is valuable. And then that led to the same technology being used in oncology. So we can do the same thing in cancer. There it's called a liquid blood biopsy. So the same thing, when cancer cells die or break loose from the main tumor, they slough DNA in the blood, and through sequencing technologies and capture technologies, we can separate that from your genetic information, which is why we had to change to genomics as one of the main ways we describe this, because that's not your genetics. Those are somatic mutations floating around in your blood from a tumor that's somewhere. We're starting to do that as screening. I did it 2 months ago. I'm not promoting anyone and I forget who's doing the test, but I paid $1,000 cash and my report said, I don't have cancer. And the test tests for 44 cancers with a pretty good sensitivity and specificity. They erred on the side of a higher specificity for low stage cancers, 1 and 2. So they're about 45% sensitive for stage 1 and 2. But if it says it, the specificity of the test is above 80%. And then for stage 3 and above, the sensitivity and specificity both approach 90%. That's a machine learning test. They're filtering the information and not calling out more positives. That's the only reason the sensitivity is not higher in stage 1 and 2. We're going to be able to identify cancer in the body before imaging can detect it. So we have to figure out what we're going to do with that information.
So is, for example, is Cologuard an example of looking for abnormal DNA in the stool?
That's a perfect example. They started it, FDA approved it. Fantastic. I love colonoscopies. I'm sure they've been tremendously valuable. They come with their own risks. Cologuard's a good test. It's a really good test. It's a great example.
Are there any other genomic tests right now that, people at an advanced age should be getting on a regular basis or on a symptom type of basis, before scans or images or so forth show potential cancers or other abnormalities?
Yeah, in the elderly population, it's really the amount of medications they're on that somewhat has me concerned. I don't know, 8 to 10 medications by the time you're in your 60s. I know we're trying to help but we're going to create adverse events at each of those points. And then we're going to have to tease out, what's part of a disease process and what's a side effect of a treatment. As a clinician, as a doctor, as soon as I start a medication, I'm thinking of how to get someone off it. Like the day I write it, how am I getting you off this? And can I ever? So they should know their pharmacogenomics, but aging changes those enzymes as well, slows a lot of them down. Cancer in the elderly, it's, we're now up to a 1 in 2, 1 in 3 rate for cancer. There, it's just better screening to diagnose at an earlier stage when we know the outcomes are so much better. So I want to use our technology there to diagnose these things. If I have to diagnose them at stage 0, I'd love to. But then what? Do I sit around and wait till it shows up on an imaging study or till another marker shows it? Do we give a little bit of chemo? I don't know what that would look like. We can now do these quantitatively. So we can use them as a quantitative marker for almost how much cancer you have floating around, these liquid tumor biopsies. So, you know, if you did and the mutation's cut in half, you know that it did something to those cells.
So right now, are there any cancers that are followed through these liquid biopsy type of tests?
Lung, I think they're doing a lot of lung because we couldn't keep going into people's lungs and getting new pieces. So what we really like to do is go biopsy the tumor. So we want a piece of the tumor, and then we do the first line treatment, and a lot of the tumor shrinks back. It dies because the treatment worked. But cancers are heterogeneous. They're different pockets of cells. And so then certain pockets live and they start to grow back. And those are a lot of times the ones that spread. Well, we can't go stick a needle in the lung again because of all the risk that comes with it. So that'll probably be the first one is lung cancer. I worked at a cancer hospital for 6 years. Maybe 5 years ago, 4 years ago, I left there. I couldn't get the doctors to move towards liquid tumor biopsies yet. A lot of the genomic testing, they were waiting to go on to the NCCN guidelines. So today they're a lot better. They're a lot more willing to try things, that don't necessarily fit, but have scientific evidence. But it's one marker, one disease, one person at a time.
This has been a great discussion. I've actually learned a lot today, Mike. Any parting thoughts? And again, for the employers that purchase healthcare that are listening, that may help them better construct their plans and future costs.
That's where we are. That's it. It's a cost thing now. The information is valuable. The Human Genome Project is one of our greatest accomplishments. Our mindset about what should have come out the other end is probably a little off. We went to the $1,000 genome. Now they want us at the $100 genome. People in my field are working towards that. If we get the cost right, if the labs are right with running the tests, if we can analyze the data right, and then if we can use the information correctly, I would say open up to any of these tests. Today, focus on CMS, Medicare, focus on FDA. Use the resources we currently have to help you make your decisions. They're doing a good job analyzing this information and approving or denying these tests and these medications. So as an employer who's footing the bill for the healthcare costs, at least offer your individuals those tests deemed important enough by CMS and FDA, at least.
Great. Hey, Mike, thank you very much. Appreciate your being on the show today and look forward to touching base with you in a few years to see what's changed.
Yeah. Thanks, Stan.
My thanks to Dr. Kaiser for sharing his knowledge and experience today. I'll leave links to the services mentioned during our conversation, as well as Dr. Kaiser's contact information in the show notes. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
We hope you've enjoyed the time with our very own Dr. Stan for 360 Degrees of Healthcare with Dr. Stan Schwartz, a part of Zero Studios. Tune in, subscribe, and review our podcast to keep current with the ins and outs of the medical and healthcare industry from the inside out.